Now, see if I can connect that story to what I was saying before. If you're traumatized, you're numb. You're not responding. That space is closed down. You're not, the flow is no longer going. You're not getting it. You look at other people who tell you things like a stunned fish. Your eyes are glazed over. You don't respond. You don't react fully. So that this was a test about whether trauma was being healed, about whether this space was open again. Okay. Now, here's another image of that space. This is Jacob's Ladder, 1395 by the Balaam Master. It's a miniature from the Bible of King Wenceslaus IV in Vienna. Angels are ascending and descending the ladder while Jacob sleeps on his pillow there at the river Jabbok. And this is, remember, at the time in the biblical story where Jacob is going back to meet Esau, the brother he has betrayed. So he's bringing the two sides of himself together in a very dramatic way, and he's confronting his shadow, and he's confronting what he did to his brother. And as he walks into that country, he has this opening between the worlds. And it's a powerful story, and one that has found its way into a lot of our literature and mythology. This is Marc Chagall's Jacob's Dream. Contrary to traditional representations, Jacob isn't sleeping here, but is standing, maybe withdrawn into himself, we can't quite tell. And while joyful-looking, sort of acrobatic angels are circling about in the ladder, going up and down, and so on. Space between the worlds. This is familiar to you now. Here's another image of the space between the worlds. Oh, the reason I put this in here is that one of the main things that we'll be talking about today is the image of the child as an intermediary between these two worlds. Right? The child who's caught on this planet and who now has to come down into this world. Here he is again. This is the Magi with a vision of the Christ child on an altarpiece. This is in the Cloisters Museum, in Metropolitan Museum in New York. Now remember, the child in this vision is also lying in a stable somewhere among the animals. A very earthly child. Okay, so there's the vision of the heavenly child, and then there's the earthly child for whom there's no room in the inn. This child, named Jesus, is a conjunctio oppositorum, a dual unity, a product of both the divine and the human, otherwise known as an incarnation. The Word becomes flesh and dwells among us, right? This kind of descent into the body of an ineffable spark or scintilla of light, the pollen of the flowering Godhead, as I just mentioned, is Winnicott talks about in his mystical language as indwelling. He says, as the mother introduces and reintroduces the baby's mind and body to each other, some mysterious something descends and takes up residence in the body. Jungian analyst Edward Edinger says the problem here is how do we maintain the light, the spark, the self with which the ego is identified in the beginning? How do we stay connected to that and also lose our identification with it? Because if we don't stay somehow connected, that's Jungian language. In Jungian language, we won't have access to the unconscious, to the organizing central archetype in the unconscious, which Jung called the self. If that, remember in Jungian language, the ego is an affiliate of the self, just like Christ is an affiliate of the Godhead. So the ego is the manifestation of the self in time and space reality, and That's the idea we're exploring here. So to have an ensouled life, then, we have to keep this channel open. Okay, I think I've probably exhausted my metaphors enough. If the space does not stay open, then a defensive structure comes up to make it survival possible, and this is my image of what it looks like. Remember I said this was the archetypal self-care system. This is the struggle then between the powers in the archetypal world that are struggling to, on the one hand, sequester and protect the innocent spark, and on the other hand, are persecuting it. What we know now is that from work with MPD patients, multiple personality disorder patients, almost always the powers, the defensive powers, start out protective. And then what happens is as experience accumulates and as these individuals who are very marginally connected oftentimes to the requirements of reality, they get wounded and rewounded in their interchanges with people and things and stuff. They become more and more angry, and the inner world becomes more and more dark and persecutory. So as life goes on, we often find that the angels change colors. The light bringer becomes a fallen angel. And then once this system is in place, this really violent defensive system, this is what we get. We get the energies of the psyche turning against the vulnerability in the self. And that becomes a very, that becomes the essence of self-destructive, the unconscious foundation for self-destructive behavior. As we remember, this isn't what happens to all Cronus's children. There was little Zeus who got protected by the Corybantes and by Rhea who hid him away. And we saw the images of the children who hide away in limbo. And even in Sandra Ingerman's book. And the child then retires into a cave and takes care of itself. It stops attaching, it stops needing. Takes care of itself. And this is the only humorous slide I have in this entire talk. I don't know what that says about me, but this is an image of the self-care system all by myself. I don't need anybody, thank you. I will take care of it all by myself. That's the mantra of the person who has stopped attaching. And Melanie Klein called it the manic defense. I don't need you. I don't need anything. I'm going to do it all by myself. And if those of you who are in therapy role, in the therapist chair, know that this is very common in what we call schizoid patients who have made a life of taking care of their own needs and not attaching. They do it all by themselves. Okay, I'm going to leave this on just to remind us what this is all about. Okay, now, innocence. I'll be using the story of the little prince in this lecture today and his new friend, who happens to be the pilot. The pilot lives down on Earth and the little prince lives up on his planet. To talk about, as a metaphor of the split internal condition and structure that follows severe trauma in the lives of some of our clients and in our lives too. What we're going to find is that the thing that draws these two worlds together is love. That's the short addition. Love and imagination. So let's go through the story together. I'm going to skip all this psychoanalytic jargon. But you get the basic idea. The little prince is up on his planet, and we don't know how he got there. The story doesn't tell us. But if we're reading the story through the lens of a trauma psychology, there was one time when the little prince existed on Earth and the pilot existed on Earth, and the two of them might have had some communication together. And the childhood reality inside the pilot was a real-life thing. The pilot led an ensouled existence, and the little prince had a chance to grow up and keep his animation and his magic as part of the adult world. But what we now know is that the pilot's down in the desert with a crashed airplane. He's lost his soul, effectively. It's up on a planet. And he is going through the motions of a life where the only thing that really brings him any thrill at all is flying his airplane and getting as high as he can. He needs air. He needs spirit. But he crashes. So he's down there without water in the desert. And that's the story of our... that's our story as it begins. Now, when our patients come into therapy, those that have had an early trauma history, they often don't know that they house within themselves, in their unconscious, a little prince on another planet. They may have a vague sense that something inside is wrong. They've lost something, something sacred maybe. Maybe that's why they come to a Jungian analyst. But the inner space between the worlds has been blocked. Sometimes it takes months or years to make contact with the innocent part of the personality. It's like those Aboriginal Stone Age people in the Amazon jungle who weren't discovered by Western anthropologists until the 1960s or 70s. You know those people in the rainforest? And sometimes working with folks with a lot of early trauma is like that. You know there's life in there, but it hasn't been seen for years, and you don't know quite how to find it. And you hack your way through the jungle, and you think you get a little glimpse of it here, and then the jungle grows up again, and you lose it, and so on. Barbara was not working with me when she had this dream that I'm going to tell you. It's a remarkable dream. It occurred as she was settling into her first Jungian analysis in another city with a female colleague whom she consulted because of anxiety and depression. She'd grown up as the over-responsible oldest daughter in an upper-middle-class family with a handsome, charismatic, but very emotionally distant father who she adored, and an emotionally unstable, narcissistic mother who she came to fear. The mother had manic depressive illness and was hospitalized several times and would literally stay up all night long writing in her journal and would often blow up at the patient and slap her. One memory that Barbara had at the age of 10 was that a strange man appeared at the door, and she wondered what it was, and she went and asked Mommy what he was doing here, and only to see the mother giving away her beloved kitten. And the mother had become extremely enraged and frustrated with this kitten's messiness around the house. Apparently the kitten had been sick, incontinent, so the mother gave her kitten away. And Barbara remembers the day that this happened and remembers saying to herself, take this in, take this in. Take a photograph of this. Remember this. Don't ever, ever trust her again. And she didn't. So that gives you a little insight into Barbara's life. I went into a cold, remote place, Barbara told me. Then, as her analysis with this other colleague started, she had this dream, a dream that stayed with her all the time and that she and I worked on too and that stayed between us. She calls it her green monster dream. I'm on a cold, dying planet, like what the Arctic might be without snow. I'm a scout for an animal preservation center. I'm on this planet to pick up surviving creatures, this time a baby mammal similar to a bear cub. It would die here, and it's the last of its kind. I'm picking up the cub creature from a way station. The cub was found and brought here by a being known as the emissary. The only hardy life form in this eerie gray world, this emissary searches out starving creatures for transport to Earth. The emissary remains behind a wall in the building because humans cannot tolerate his form. It is his choice to remain there, for the wall protects him from human revulsion. I find the emissary's mission and his plight very poignant. I see the little cub, wrapped in a dirty, almost slimy fur blanket, rather like a polar bear's coat. I suddenly realize the blanket is alive too. It's another creature from this planet. The voice of the emissary behind the wall is telling me how to care for the cub. And he explains that he found the blanket animal out there also, abandoned. He explains that it kept the cub warm, and he hopes we will take it back to the earth also. The emissary's voice is clear, cultured, and kind. I wonder how a being with such a beautiful voice can be too ugly to permit itself to be seen. I pick up both creatures and prepare to leave. Then the emissary asks if I would mind if he held the blanket creature with its wrapped-up cub just one more time. I am achingly moved. I suddenly wonder, could this be a baby of his kind? And is that why he hides? The emissary tells me to step close to the wall, a smooth metallic surface in which there is a round opening.